Western North Carolina's history is woven through with stories of the Cherokee people as well as the Mountaineers who settled there during the colonial era. In our time, George Ellison has written often about that region's cultural and natural history. For the past three decades, he has lived there, surrounded by the Great Smoky Mountains, and written essays about both his own experiences and the stories of the mountain people. These have now been assembled into a book. It is called Mountain Passages, and George Ellison joins us by phone right now. Hi there, George Ellison.
Hello.
Hi. Well, we should note that as much as you have been tied in so closely to the mountains, you are actually talking to us today from your vacation on the Outer Banks.
Yeah, we're at Duck, which is north of Hatteras, and out the window I can see Albemarle Sound, which is about as flat as a pancake. It does us good to get away, my wife and I, several times a year. But come next Friday, we'll be driving home. We get to Marion or Morganton on I-40. We'll look out to the west and see the Blue Ridge and know that we're coming back home.
Right. So about those mountains, what is it that that drew you to them and draws you still?
Well, there's a unique blend of both the natural history and the human history there. There's great natural diversity in the southern mountains, particularly here in western North Carolina, 33 or 34 peaks over 6,000 feet. So you have lots of northern flora and fauna extending this far south that you wouldn't otherwise get, blending with our typical southeastern flora and fauna, and great diversities of major forest zones and microhabitats that made a patchwork quilt of natural history. And then the human history intertwines itself with that natural history. Early Indians arriving perhaps as many as 10,000 years ago. There's an archaeological dig being done on Cherokee lands in Swain County now that are turning up points dating back 10,000 years ago. And then the Cherokees themselves emerging about 1,000 years ago as a distinct people. In came the early white settlers, and then lastly, newcomers like myself who are trying to make a home there. So the natural and human diversity and trying to write about it and figure out what it's all about and piece it together.
Mm-hmm. Well, you divide your book, Mountain Passages, into several segments, and one of them is about the natural history that you just touched on. One of your themes, though, is this idea of the moving water. And I was wondering if you might give us just a little reading from your opening chapter there.
Yeah, it's called Magical Waters. And when I assembled the essays for this book, I didn't realize how many of them would touch upon water. But it's not surprising in retrospect because water is the essence of mountain culture, both natural history and the human history. And the opening essay or chapter in the book is entitled Magical Waters and goes this way, some of the paragraphs. Creeks are as central to life here in western North Carolina as the mountains themselves. You can't have mountains like the ones found here without the seeps, springs, branches, creeks, and rivers that form them. Flowing water was the primary agent that sculpted the mountain landscapes as we know them today. The word creek, in addition to being defined as a small stream, often a shallow or intermittent tributary to a river, also means any turn or winding, any turn or winding. The word may derive from the Old Norse kriki, K-R-I-K-I, meaning a bend, a nook. Bends and nooks are the essence of any creek. They are magical places where the water swirls and threads its way over and among a jumble of boulders, disappears under a cut bank, braids its way through a sluice, purls in an eddy, and glints in the winter sunlight. Ask anyone here in western North Carolina who doesn't reside in a town or settlement where he lives or she lives, and he or she more often than not will designate either a mountain or a creek. Many will say something like, "Well, I live up at the head of Kirkland Creek," or "I live down on Snowbird," which means they live on Snowbird Creek in Graham County. Or they might say, "Hey, I live out at Larkey," which means they live on a Larker Creek in Swain County. Mountain pathways almost inevitably wind down to and alongside creeks. They are irresistible. Each bend and nook has its own voice, the unique set of sounds that arises from the confluence of water running at a given rate over a particular configuration of logs and stones. We are attracted, when moody or meditative, to certain creeks where these sounds become voices that speak to us quite clearly.
George Ellison reading from his collection of essays. It is called Mountain Passages. He has been a columnist for the Smoky Mountain News, has been writing about Western North Carolina for better part of three decades, and lives near the Great Smoky Mountains in Western North Carolina. So was it the mountains or the water that drew you there?
Well, the mountains themselves were the first attraction, I guess, initially being near the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and now Coville Valley that we live in is surrounded on three sides by the park. And then as we started to explore it and get a knowledge of it, the importance of water both in our lives, the creek that runs through our property, as well as in Cherokee life, they were continually going to water for cleansing and purifying. And then, as I mentioned in the reading just a moment ago, the importance of creeks to mountain people, that they grow up on the creeks and identify with them. So it's sort of a natural progression once you start taking a closer look at things to see the essence of that.
We are talking with George Ellison about his book, Mountain Passages. Just ahead, more of our conversation, and we will take your calls about life in North Carolina's mountains. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. All of that just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and we are talking with George Ellison about life in the North Carolina mountains. His new book is called Mountain Passages, Natural and Cultural History of Western North Carolina and the Great Smoky Mountains, which is where he lives, surrounded, I gather, on three sides, at least, by the national park there.
Right.
Our number is 1-877-962-9862. And just before the break, George Ellison, you read a passage in which you talked about the importance of creeks in the mountains as being such a part of that geography there. They come up several times in your book, and there's one chapter there, and perhaps you can read or at least tell us the story. It dates back to the 1700s, and there is a bishop who is trying to lead his congregation to a new settlement. Unfortunately for them, he doesn't have a real good grasp on the topography. Or does he even have a map at all? Or?
No map at all. It would have been very crude if he had. One of my interests, Melinda, is the early natural history writing about the Blue Ridge part of Western North Carolina. And someday I'd like to put together an anthology of those writings. But in investigating the origins of it, I found this fabulous diary that was kept by Bishop Augustus Gottlieb Spangenberg, who was a member of the Moravian Church. Indeed, he was the assistant to Count Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf. And when Lord Granville said that the Moravians in the mid-18th century could survey a tract of 100,000 acres of land in North Carolina, out in the Piedmont of the Mountains, Zinzendorf sent Spangenberg out to do that with a company of men, and they were actually the first to penetrate into the Blue Ridge, and Spangenberg's diary is, to my knowledge, the first record in which there are natural history descriptions of the Blue Ridge. William Byrd almost got here in 1728 when he was surveying the dividing line. And, of course, William Bartram, the famous botanist and writer, came in 1775. So Spangenberg was the first, and it's a wonderful document that I sort of described in one of the chapters. And I'd like to read, could I read to you a
Please
few
do.
Lines from that?
Okay. Sure.
This is by November the 24th. This is November the 24th, 1752. Now think about this. His party had penetrated the true wilderness that then existed in the western Piedmont area, that is, west of Winston-Salem. And his diary entry goes, "The land is very rich and has been much frequented by buffalo, whose tracks are everywhere and can often be followed with profit. Frequently, however, a man cannot travel them, for they go through thick and thin, through morass and deep water, and up and down banks so steep that a man could fall down, but neither ride nor walk. The wolves here give us music every morning from six corners at once, such music as I've never heard in Germany, Poland, and Livonia." He also goes on to describe panthers and other animals. And then they finally penetrate up the Blue Ridge Escarpment into what we consider the Blue Ridge proper. They were actually penetrating the area around Boone, North Carolina. And he gives this first landscape description of the Blue Ridge. "When we reached the top, we saw mountains to the right and to the left, before and behind us, many hundreds of mountains rising like great waves in a storm." And that's a description that someone could write today, but he was the first to do it. And then a couple of more sentences from the end of his diary, after much travail, found their way lost and forlorn through the mountains for 3 weeks. They finally got back into the Piedmont area, and the diary concludes, "Here we are at last after a difficult journey among the mountains. We were completely lost, and whichever way we turned, we were walled in. Not one of our company had ever been there before, and path or trail were unknown. Though how can one speak of path or trail when none existed? One height rose behind the other, and we traveled between hope and fear, distressed for our horses, which had nothing to eat. At last we reached a stream," this was actually a tributary of the Yadkin River, "at last we reached a stream flowing rapidly down the mountain, followed it, and happily reached this side of the Blue Ridge. We also found pasturage for our horses, and oh, how glad we were."
It does sound like a long journey to be happy.
Yeah,
it was over.
And so for that reason, the Moravians decided that it would be impossible to settle that far west, and of course, surveyed lands in where the present-day Winston-Salem is situated.
We are talking with George Ellison, author of Mountain Passages, and it's a collection of stories, his own observations and historical record of the cultural and natural history of the western part of North Carolina. Christina joins us on the line from Asheboro. Christina, I understand you can actually relate to the bishop who went through those mountains rather lost in the 1700s?
Oh, yes, definitely, and thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I was just wanting to comment on that. I was listening, and I am recently married, and my husband and I had our honeymoon in Nashville, Tennessee, and we jumped back on the Blue Ridge Parkway and decided to take it all the way up before we came home. Well, there was a detour, and we ended up getting lost in the mountains, and we followed right along the base of the mountains and ended up in a town called Cranberry, North Carolina. And there was this creek right along the winding road, and my husband was having a fit, not knowing, you know, it was really a test of our faith in one another.
Uh-huh.
And I just kept saying, well, we're fine, you know, follow the creek, follow the road. But it was the most wonderful experience to just be lost in those mountains, and I cannot wait to read Mountain Passages now. I'm so glad I was listening to the show today.
Well, I appreciate that. I think there's a little bit of something in there for everyone, with natural history and then the Cherokee history and lore, and then various vignettes and biographical sketches of white pioneers, and on down to the present day. So it's a little bit of something for everyone. And so many people are attracted to the mountains when they think about we're going to get away from it all. Many of them choose to come to the mountains of North Carolina to refresh themselves and recharge their batteries.
And sometimes getting lost is part of it.
Sometimes it's getting lost. Whenever I get lost, I always start feeling happy because I know something's going to happen.
Great. Well, thanks so much for your call, and congratulations, Christina.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-877-962-9862. Michael is in Burlington. Greetings, Michael.
Good afternoon. I hope y'all are doing well.
Ooh. Yeah.
I was curious. I'm a frequent visitor to the area around Highlands and Cashiers,
yeah,
North Carolina.
I'm up there a lot doing workshops.
And was curious to find out what you know about the historical standpoint of Whiteside Mountain in relation to the Indians.
Well, the Cherokees, of course, had no written language until 1820s when Sequoia invented the alphabet, and then thereafter they did have a written language. So their history and lore was passed down orally, and they attached the stories and things to particular physical places that were significant, that gave them more continuity from generation to generation. And Whiteside Mountain, which is impressive mountain, some of the highest vertical cliff faces in eastern North America, there's a cliff face that's about 1,200 feet vertical. They associated a story about a witch, an ogre called the Spearfanger, and had a story associated with how she lived there and how she created Whiteside Mountain and how she was finally able to, the Cherokees were finally able to slay that monster that lived at Whiteside Mountain named Spearfanger. Is that the sort of thing you were asking? Hello?
I take kids up there a lot, and we'll have picnics, and it's always nice to... during the picnic, talk about where you are and what happened
One,
there.
One thing that many listeners to this program are familiar with, the Highlands Cashiers area. Mm-hmm. Almost everyone in North Carolina has been there, and it's a very dramatic area. And the thing that I make a point of when I'm teaching natural history workshops in that area is that the Eastern Continental Divide comes through that area of western North Carolina, almost down Whiteside Mountain, not exactly, and down through Highlands. And I think what made it such a dramatic landscape there, with all the vertical cliffs and steep gorges in that area, is for whatever reasons, and I'm not a geologist, so I can't go into detail, but for whatever reason, there must have been a lot of wastage and soil erosion at the end of the last ice age along that particular part of the Eastern Continental Divide that created that, what is to me a unique landscape in at least the southern mountains of eastern North America. It's right. A great getaway area.
Well, Michael, right. thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
And Rebecca is in Raleigh. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I lived in East Africa for a little while with a tribe that was nomadic, and they had never seen helicopters, and helicopters were arriving because there was the possibility of oil. And I prayed, oh, dear, let there be no oil. And I have a similar feeling when I think of the mountains in western North Carolina. They're beautiful. They've been pristine, and suddenly now we've discovered them. Mm-hmm. And I just would be interested in your commentary, you know, on all this development. I worry about avalanches. I worry about overdevelopment and greed. I worry about all that you're describing that's so beautiful and sensitive and touching that would lift our spirits being ground into the ground with greed. And I'm going to go offline. I just would love to hear you talk about it. I need an encouraging word.
Yeah, I'm sort of the sunshine guy when it comes to natural history and environmental issues. I try to, in my writing, or I teach workshops for the North Carolina Arboretum and Smoky Mountain Field School, I try to take people out and introduce them to the natural world as we have it now and show them how much we do have that has been preserved and can still be preserved, and help them to get a feeling for why it should be preserved. And then when those who are doing working in the other end of the garden come along and start talking about particular issues and particular needs for preserving it, then they can do so. But it's something that certainly one has to keep an eye on and hope that things will somehow work out, that a lot of it's not destroyed. Some of you may have seen the movie The Songcatcher, and the director for that's a good movie. My wife did some paintings for it. But they have the one of the main characters, the villain, is a representative for a coal mining company in western North Carolina. And we tried to tell her that the extractive industry in western North Carolina was not coal, where we have none of that, but the timber industry. But she thought that coal mining was for some reason more sexy and interesting than timber logging. But the logging the timber, protecting the ridge crest, and mainly, as a lot of stress so far in this program, protecting the waterways. As long as we have clear water, then it's all going to work. Once that goes, if we don't take care of it, then none of it will work. Mm-hmm. That's such a broad issue. I feel like I've barely touched on it, but I did my best.
Well, you write about the historical record in these areas. There's one particular person you write about, David Greer, who had been just tell us the story about him. He had been a hermit, had he not?
Well, the title of that essay, which was originally a column in Smoky Mountain News, is titled "The Hermit of Bald Mountain, David Greer," and I have lived for the last 30 years in rather rustic circumstances, but I would never qualify as a hermit.
Now, how do you define rustic?
Well, we live back in a cove, and we live with wood stoves and wood cook stoves and kerosene lanterns and those kinds of things. Just sort of by chance we evolved that kind of lifestyle.
Do you have electricity where you live?
No.
Oh. Oh, that is very rustic.
But in my wife's gallery studio in town, we've got computers and TVs and internet and all that, so we live sort of in two worlds. But anyway, even though I would never qualify as a hermit, since I've got a wife and three children and five grandchildren, I don't think hermits are allowed to have those. I've always sort of played around with the idea of what it would like to be one, and I opened that essay with sort of tongue-in-cheek. Mountain landscapes throughout the world have many associations, and I talk about all the hermits in the Himalayas, where every peak has its resident hermit. And then I get into, my essays tend to be a little discursive. I'll start off with one point and then wander into what the main objective is. And so I did a little research and noticed that the only real hermit that I could dig up was a fellow named David Greer, G-R-I-E-R, whose story has been retold in several historical accounts. And Greer moved into the mountains in 1798, and fell in love with a young girl whose father, Colonel David Vance, wasn't happy with having Grier around, so his suit was not encouraged, and the father forced the young lady to marry another. And Grier's mind, apparently entirely crazed, plunged into the wilderness. This was about 1802, and on reaching the bald summit of a peak that's Bald Mountain now, or Grier Mountain, he built a log house and cleared a tract of 9 acres, and lived there 20 miles from habitation for a number of years. But then finally, as the previous caller was talking about, encroachment started to happen to this hermit. People started to wander onto the lands, and it enraged him. And finally, one poor fellow named Holland Higgins, perhaps not knowing what he was in for, wandered on to Grier's lands and was killed by Grier. And Grier was not prosecuted on the grounds that he was insane. But some of Higgins' friends later came and executed Grier in retaliation. And the essay closes in this way: according to author's rendering, or according to historical renderings of McDowell's account, Grier, after killing Higgins, had published a pamphlet in justification of his act. And after his own death, he left papers of interest containing his own life's record and views of life in general, showing that he was a deist and a believer in the right of every man to take the executive power of the law into his own hands. Then I conclude that essay with this sentence: for whatever reasons, violent endings are often the hermit's fate. It may be that martyrdom is the same thing that some of them are seeking in the first place. And, Melinda, do you remember the story of Eric Rudolph?
Yes, sure do.
Several people have contacted me since reading that essay about David Grier and asked me if I saw parallels in that, and I had to think it through and thought no. Rudolph, who was the bomber of the abortion clinic in Montgomery and a bomber of the Atlanta Olympics, was not, although he had great outdoor skills and was able to hide away from the FBI for a number of years very recently, he was a woodsman of some skill, but doesn't qualify as a hermit because he was a fugitive of sorts. And then he chose not martyrdom, but rather life in sentence in jail.
Well, George Ellison, I'd like to thank you for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure. I appreciate your interest in the book and hope that some folks will pick it up and take a look at it.
Great. George Ellison is author of Mountain Passages, Natural and Cultural History of Western North Carolina and the Great Smoky Mountains. And for today, that's the state of things. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment about our program and you care to do some writing, you can send us an email here at sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. We're a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Melinda Pencava.